More and more people are living alone. In 1971, 17% of all households in England consisted of one person living alone. The latest figure, only recently published, is 28%. That means between a quarter and a third of all homes in this country are lived in by one person on his or her own. Not just, that is, excluding not just the married, but also excluding those who live with a live-in boyfriend or girlfriend. Between a quarter and a third of all houses are lived in by people living on their own. And yet a considerable number of these people, not all, but almost certainly most, would like to be married, or at least to have a steady, meaningful relationship. I don't think anyone has charted this as well in our modern day as the playwright Stephen Sondheim. I'm a great admirer of his work, and in particular he looks at this subject of singleness in his musical, which is simply called Company. The hero of this work is a man called Robert, or Bobby, and the time is his 35th birthday. And all his friends are either married or in steady relationships. Most of them are unhappy. And yet they spend the entire play trying to persuade him to get married. And throughout the play he vacillates. He hasn't got any great role models of marriage among his friends, and he values his independence. And yet, and I want to play you now, and I'm also going to put up on the screen, because I think this is typical, perhaps, of several who are single. I want to put up on the screen and play you the final song. The words that go up on the screen may not be precisely what you hear, because the printed word and the sung from the stage version isn't always identical. But here we go.
Bobby, we've been trying to call
Bobby,
you.
Bobby, Bobby,
oh,
so I've got something to tell
Bobby,
you.
Bobby, we've been trying to reach
Bobby,
you.
Bobby,
Bobby, Bobby,
Bobby,
Bobby, Bobby, Bobby, Bobby,
Bobby,
Bobby,
Bobby,
Bobby, Bobby,
Bobby,
Bobby,
Bobby,
Bobby,
Bobby,
Bobby,
Bobby,
Bobby,
Bobby,
Bobby,
Bobby, Bobby,
Bobby,
what do you get? Someone to hold you too close. Someone to hurt you too deep. Someone to sit in your chair to ruin your sleep.
We're getting divorced, Bobby.
We haven't told anyone yet.
Listen, not everybody should be married, I guess.
To me, a man should be married.
Someone to need you too much. Someone to know you too well. Someone to pull you up short, to put you through hell.
Well, you gotta give up to get, you know what I'm saying?
And unlike my father, I'm a very happy man.
Oh, I just heard a door open. That's been stuck a long time.
You just see what you look for, you know.
Someone you have to let in. Someone whose feelings you spare. Someone who, like it or not, will want you to share a little, a lot.
You've so many reasons for not being with someone, but Robert, you haven't got one good reason for being alone.
It's much better living it than looking at it, Robert.
Someone to crowd you with love. Someone to force you to care. Someone to make you come through, who'll always be there, as frightened as you of being alive. Being alive.
Blow out your candles, Robert.
and make a wish. Want something. Want something.
Somebody hold me too close. Somebody hurt me too deep. Somebody sit in my chair and ruin my sleep and make me aware of being alive, being alive. Somebody need me too much. Somebody know me too well. Somebody pull me up short and put me through hell and give me support for being alive. Make me alive. Make me alive.
It's very telling, isn't it? And that mixture that one finds in today's world of a certain cynicism about marriage, and yet perhaps the key line is this one here. Alone is alone, not alive. That's his conclusion. That to be single, or at least to be unattached, is to be half dead, and to be alive is to be in a relationship. And many people, secretly or openly, feel like that. I want to stress, not all single people do, but many. What is the Christian church to say to them, to us all, about singleness? The sad answer is nothing. So often, nothing. As I was researching my book on divorce and remarriage, which has considerable sections on singleness, I went into what was then my local Christian bookshop in Somerset. I went up to the assistant, having looked around the shelves. I said, I can see the section on marriage and the family, but where is your section on singleness? She looked at me with complete blank look on the face and eventually said, "Do you mean single parenting?" There was not a single book in the shop on the single life. And when books are published, as indeed they are on the subject, they are often full of people's experiences, struggles, pains. I'm reading one precisely at the moment. But there's no wrestling with the Bible, no attempt so often to see it from God's perspective. The same is true in our liturgies, in our prayers. We use a book in our own Anglican church, which some of you may have seen, called Church Family Worship. And it has sections of thematic worship for periods throughout the year. One of the loveliest confessions in that is a confession based on scriptural texts where, for example, fathers confess to being inadequate fathers, mothers to being ineffective and inadequate mothers, children to being disobedient children, and so on. And so in different sections of the confession, different ones of us join in. It's great, but there is a notable omission. Single people don't get a look in. Perhaps because they thought there was nothing in the Bible about singleness, and therefore nothing to live up to, and nothing to confess. It's true again in our preaching and teaching in churches. Almost all of us will have heard many sermons in churches on marriage and on family life. When have you heard a sermon devoted specifically to the single life? You go into our youth groups, and there's a lot of teaching on relationships, on preparing for marriage, on sexual purity, and so on. But when in our youth groups do we put before our young people the option of singleness for a short term or indeed for life? And how about Christian friends? So often Christian friends give us no support in seeking to live a life as a single Christian man or woman. And sometimes it seems that whenever we face any problem, any struggle, whether it's in work or in making friends or in illness, the spoken or unspoken attitude is, if only he were married, if only she were married, that would be the major solution to their problems. And sadly, our own human families often put pressure on us, again spoken or unspoken, in the same direction. And this from the body, the Christian church, that brought about on the world stage, objectively, a revolutionary and utterly positive new view of singleness that changed the ancient world's thinking about the single state. Well, today in our two sessions, I want first to ask, what does the Bible teach us about singleness? That's what we'll be looking at before coffee. And then secondly, how can Christians live out the Bible's positive teaching about singleness? And I begin with the Old Testament. The basic attitude of the Old Testament is expressed in the very first reference on your sheets, Genesis 2, verse 18. Then the Lord God said, such a famous reference, "It is not good that the man should be alone." Human beings, we're taught right at the outset of the Old Testament, were never meant to be solitary. It is not good for them. And God says in the second half of verse 18, "I will make a helper fit for him." That little phrase, "fit for him," is one very simple word in the Hebrew, and it means literally like and over against him. In other words, different from him, but not totally different, corresponding to him. The best translation perhaps in English is the word "his counterpart." And you remember, of course, that God first tries out the animals. He creates the animals and brings them to the man. But the verdict comes at the end of verse 20, "But for the man in these animals, there was not found a helper fit for him." Only a fellow human being will do, and specifically a woman. And when Eve is created and brought to Adam, Adam cries out in delight, verse 23, "This at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man." And this, says the writer of Genesis, explains marriage, this perfect counterpart that God has created for the man. Verse 24, "Therefore a man leaves his father and mother and cleaves to his wife, and they become one flesh. And this in Old Testament, men and women, bred two attitudes. First, the tragedy of not being married. That's how the Old Testament man or woman felt, that it was tragic not to be married. And I think this is very poignantly brought out in the next reference that I've put down there, the story of Jephthah. You remember Jephthah was one of the judges. He headed up an Israelite coalition against the Ammonites. And before the decisive battle, he made a rash vow to the Lord that if God gave him victory, he would sacrifice the first person who met him on his return. Showing, of course, in itself a sort of mix of authentic Israelite and pagan belief. Human sacrifice was never something that the God of Israel asked for. And then tragically, the first person who came out to meet him was his own daughter. Now let me take up the story from verse 37 as I've printed it out here. Jephthah's daughter said to her father, let this thing be done for me, that is, before your vow is fulfilled. Grant me 2 months so that I may go and wander on the mountains and bewail my virginity, my companions and I. Go, said her father, and he sent her away for 2 months. So she departed, she and her companions, and bewailed her virginity on the mountains. At the end of 2 months, she returned to her father, who did with her according to the vow he had made. She had never slept with a man. So there arose an Israelite custom that for 4 days every year, the daughters of Israel would go out to lament the daughter of Jephthah, the Gileadite. How awful it is, thinks the Old Testament man or woman, never to have slept with a man, literally in that lovely Hebrew phrase, never to have known a man, and never to be married. And many people feel that today. The book I'm reading at the moment is a book by a woman called Kathy, I don't quite know how you pronounce her name, K-E-A-Y, about her own singleness. And I'm just at a part now where at the age, again, actually, of 35, she is going on holiday to the USA. And she wonders, just before she sets out, what it would be like to go over there and in the anonymity of a holiday to get pregnant and have a baby. Single person, but feeling that it's tragic that she's not married, and at 35 she's beginning to feel that time's running out for having a child. And then the second attitude which this Old Testament idea expressed in Genesis 2, bread, is the desperate desire to be married. And here we turn to the book of Isaiah, to Israel in the 8th century BC. And Isaiah, along with most of the 8th century prophets, is prophesying the wholesale destruction, this is number 7 on your sheet over the page, of the army, with the consequence that men are going to become very thin on the ground. Now, Isaiah chapter 3, verse 25. God says, your men shall fall by the sword, and your warriors in battle, and her gates shall lament and mourn. Ravaged, Israel shall sit upon the ground. 7 women shall take hold of 1 man in that day, saying, we will eat our own bread and wear our own clothes. Just let us be called by your name. Take away our disgrace. The women say, I'm not going to ask anything of you. You won't have to be the breadwinner. You won't have to buy me clothes. Just let me change my name to yours, because it's such a disgrace to be single. Sometimes it seems like that, doesn't it, in the Christian churches? That men are so thin on the ground that one eligible male who's got some character to him comes into a church and a lot of the single women are interested in him, buzzing around him. At least that's how it seems to the single women. Often the single men see it rather differently. Well, now that I've tried to sketch rather briefly is the normative attitude of the Old Testament towards marriage and singleness. And yet there are other strands of teaching. The Old Testament has a great deal to say about friendship, about same-sex friendship. Look, for example, at the top of this same page that you're on, I hope, number 6, at Ecclesiastes chapter 4, famous passage. Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their toil. This for the tape is from verse 9. For if they fall, one will lift the other up. But woe to one who is alone and falls and does not have another to help. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? And though one might prevail against another, two will withstand one. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. And this passage is often used in wedding sermons. Two are better than one, says Ecclesiastes. Therefore, the preacher concludes, it's better to be married than to be single. How glad you must be to leave the single state. And then the preacher goes on normally to spiritualize the end. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. Well, of course, this is talking about a married couple with Jesus at the center of their lives, isn't it? Actually, it's not about marriage at all. Despite verse 11, if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? This is, of course, a reference to same-sex sharing a bed, as frequently today in third world countries. No, this whole passage is about friendship. It's about having a close friend. When it says two are better than one because they have a great reward for their toil, or a group of friends. And that's the point of the last sentence. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. Two may be better than one, three is better still, says Ecclesiastes about friendship. And here again is the same note in Ecclesiastes as in Genesis 2. It is not good for a man or a woman to be alone. Look at verse 10b. Woe to one who is alone and falls and does not have another to help. But that need for companionship is here answered not by a wife, but by a friend. The comparison with marriage is seen specifically in the friendship between David and Jonathan. When Jonathan dies, if you turn back to the front page, David issues his great lament. And perhaps the high point of it is here in 2 Samuel 1, verses 25 and 26, number 4 on your sheet. How the mighty have fallen in the midst of the battle. Jonathan lies slain upon your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Greatly beloved were you to me. Your love was wonderful to me, passing the love of women. David certainly knew about the love of women. He had, of course, several wives. And yet to him the friendship of Jonathan was something richer still. And specifically, they were a spiritual encouragement to each other. If you look back at the previous verses, 1 Samuel 23, verses 15 and 16, David was afraid because Saul had come out to seek his life. He was on the run. David was in the wilderness of Ziph at Horesh, and Jonathan, Saul's son, rose and went to David at Horesh, in this lovely phrase, and strengthened his hand in God. Some married couples are able wonderfully to be a spiritual encouragement to each other. And yet a surprising number of husbands and wives find it hard to pray together, even harder to read the Bible together. And very often the greatest spiritual support comes from friends, normally of the same sex. Nevertheless, the normal Old Testament attitude was that marriage and bearing and raising children was what every godly person would desire. And nothing very positive is said in the Old Testament about being single. And in the later period, the intertestamental and later period, this was only stated more strongly. Here are two statements from the Talmud. The man who is not married at 20 is living in sin. Or again, any man who has no wife is no proper man. All rabbis were married. Thurian, in his book Marriage and Celibacy, says that there is only one exception known in the history of Judaism. He was a man called Rabbi Ben Azai, he lived about 100 AD, and he was had up before his peers to justify himself for not being married. He was considered to be disobeying God. But he defended himself, but he actually upheld the normative view by saying, and I quote him, "He who does not concern himself with propagation and increase is considered by Scripture as if he diminished the image of God, which is man." Now into this world, this Old Testament, and then still perhaps more sharply, Jewish world, the Christian teaching about singleness exploded like a bombshell. And it's found at its fullest and clearest in the chapter, part of which John read to us, 1 Corinthians chapter 7. So would you turn now to the beginning of that, which is number 13 on page 3 of your handout. It begins in verse 1. "Now, concerning the matters about which you wrote, it is well for a man not to touch a woman." Now, the New Revised Standard Version here is almost certainly correct in printing this in inverted commas. In 1 Corinthians, Paul is very clearly answering a number of questions which had been addressed to him by the Corinthian church. And the statement in the second half of verse 1 here is almost certainly a quotation from the correspondence which he received from the Corinthians. They were saying, it is well for a man not to touch a woman. And by this they meant to touch was a euphemism or a shorthand for have sexual intercourse with. What they were meaning specifically was, as he goes on to explain, that a husband should not have intercourse in their view with his wife. There was a view, it wasn't necessarily the majority view, that there was a view within Corinth that matter was evil, of course a basically Greek view, therefore the body was evil, and therefore the spiritual thing to do was to refrain from intercourse. Actually, there seems to have been another group within Corinth who, starting from the same premise, went on to believe that therefore it was quite immaterial spiritually what you did with the body, and if you went out and slept with prostitutes, that had no spiritual repercussions at all. But it's not that that he's dealing with in chapter 7, it's the more ascetic view that one should not have sexual intercourse with one's wife at all. And Paul answers in verse 2, "But because of cases of sexual immorality," he's just been talking in the previous chapter about visits to prostitutes, "each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband." Now this is not saying that all should marry. That would completely contradict the whole of the rest of the chapter. But again, the word have is used not only here but in other places in the New Testament as, again, a shorthand for to have intercourse with. And verse 3 and following makes that clear. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal, it's quite clear from the passage that follows, meaning her sexual rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. Incidentally, the New International Version makes an absolute pig's ear of these verses and completely mistranslates it. So if you have these, if you have the New International Version and the first two or three verses here, I'm afraid it is entirely unreliable at that point. But having spoken to the married against this background of the Corinthians' view, he turns to the unmarried. He actually begins in verse 7, though he specifically mentions them in verse 8. Let me go from verse 7. I wish that all were as I myself am, but each has a particular gift from God, one having one kind and another a different kind. To the unmarried and the widows, I say that it is well for them to remain unmarried as I am. Now this may be a deliberate echo of Genesis 2:18. Well here is the Greek word kalon, good. Good with a sense of beautiful and lovely. It's exactly the same word that is used in the Greek translation of Genesis 2:18. It is not good for the man to be alone. Here Paul says to the unmarried and the widows, I say that it is good for them to remain unmarried, as I am. Well, why? How is it that Paul can come to this conclusion? And here I think we want to turn to the passage that John read to us. It's over the page at verses 25 to 38, where specifically Paul compares and contrasts marriage and singleness. And he ends with the statement in verse 38, so then he who marries his fiancée does well, and he who refrains from marriage will do better. He directly compares marriage and singleness. He says marriage certainly is good, but he says that singleness is better. On what grounds? Is it that Paul was a curmudgeonly old bachelor who rather resented marriage in anybody else? Not at all. He may well, in fact, have been married previously as a rabbi or as someone trained in a rabbinical school. It's actually comparatively unlikely that he was permanently, as it were, unmarried. It's probable that his wife, he had been married, and that his wife had died, or possibly that he had divorced her. He has, of course, very rich things to say about marriage. Ephesians 5 is in many ways the high point of the New Testament teaching on marriage. No, he says that marriage or singleness is better than marriage because of his theology. Now again, he's responding to a question that he's been asked. He's been asked a question about, verse 25, virgins. And in context, it is clear that virgins here has a specialist meaning. It means engaged couples during the time of their engagement, which might be for a long time, and before marriage. And hence, in verses 36 and 37, when he comes back specifically to their question of virgins, the NRSV, I think, quite rightly translates here, if anyone thinks that he is not behaving properly towards his fiancée, literally virgin, if his passions are strong and so it has to be, let him marry us as he wishes. It's no sin, let them marry. But if someone stands firm in his resolve, being under no necessity, but having his own desire under control and is determined in his own mind to keep her as his fiancée, he will do well. So then he who marries his fiancée does well, and he who refrains from marriage does better. But although it is specifically this rather narrow question of what to do in an engaged couple which he has been asked, and although he returns to that at the end, Paul, as so often, broadens out and speaks much more generally about being married and to the unmarried. So in verse 34, he says a little way through there, the unmarried woman and the virgin are anxious about the affairs of the Lord. In other words, if you're unmarried, whether you're engaged, you are technically, this technical use of the word virgin, or you're more generally unmarried, you're anxious about the affairs of the Lord. Again, in verse 32, he turns it to the man, the unmarried man in general, is anxious about the affairs of the Lord, and so on. So in this passage, he is speaking not just to the specific group, but to the unmarried more generally. And he says here that there are three great advantages to singleness. The first is that it can loosen our ties to the world. It can loosen our ties to the world. And here let me read again the first paragraph, verses 25 to 31. Now, concerning virgins, says St. Paul, I have no command of the Lord, but I give my opinion as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. I think that in view of the present distress, it is well for you to remain as you are. Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be free. Are you free from a wife? Do not seek a wife. But if you marry, you do not sin, and if a virgin marries, she does not sin. Yet those who marry will experience distress in this life, and I would spare you that. I mean, brothers and sisters, the appointed time has grown short. From now on, let even those who have wives be as though they had none, and those who mourn as though they were not mourning, and those who rejoice as though they were not rejoicing, and those who buy as though they had no possessions, and those who deal with the world as though they had no dealings with it. For the present form of this world is passing away. Now, all Christians, the New Testament makes clear, and indeed this very passage makes clear, are to live for the future, recognizing that this world is passing away, it's only with us for a very short time, and a glorious and very different future awaits us. All Christians are to learn to sit loose to this world. That includes the married, verse 29. I mean, brothers and sisters, the appointed time has grown short. From now on, let even those who have wives be as though they had none. This does not, of course, mean neglecting our wives and children if we're married. The very first passage, which I only touched on in this passage, answering their statement, it's well for a man not to touch a woman, is saying precisely no. In that specific case, you must have regular intercourse, he's saying, with each other. But what this does mean in verse 29 is that the married are not to act as if our marriage and our family were the most important thing in life, or as if our marriage were eternal. As we shall see later, it is not. Similarly, he goes on in verse 30, the sadnesses and joys that come from the ups and downs of this life should affect us Christians less than the non-Christian, because we have a completely different eternal perspective. That's why Paul says, those who mourn should act as though they were not mourning, and those who rejoice as though they were not rejoicing. We may love beautifying our home. We may get a kick out of business deals. But these things cannot be as important to us, because we recognize that this world is passing. It is not the solid reality that will last. And that's why Paul says at the end of verse 30, those who buy should act as though they had no possessions. For at the end of verse 31, the present form of this world is passing away. Now I repeat, all Christians are to loosen their ties with the world. But Paul's point is that this can especially be done by those who are single. Verses 25 and 26. Now concerning the virgins, I have no command of the Lord, but I give my opinion as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. I think that in view of the present distress, it is well for you to remain as you are. Remaining single, says Paul, will mean that you have less trouble in this world. He repeats it again in verse 32. I want you to be free from anxieties. That's the negative side, the thing we leave behind. And positively, we have more opportunities to do what he says in verses 29, 30, and 31, and that is to detach ourselves from this world. And any married person knows this. Let me take the field of money. Because of this, my parents are still alive, but because of certain circumstances, I basically received what I would receive on their death during their lifetime. And as a single person, I decided that I was in a position to and was happy to give that all away. So I set up a charitable trust and put all the money into it. Now I'm married. And on my wife's mother's death, her father has already died, there will obviously be a certain, probably quite considerable legacy coming in to our family from that direction. Indeed, when my own parents die, there'll be something that will come towards me. I would now find it very, very much more difficult to give away that money. I have a wife, I have children going through education. I'd find it very much harder. Take another field, possessions. And I'm speaking from my own experience here because it's easier to do so. I find I used to live happily with very few possessions. A lot of books, it's true, but very few possessions other than that. And do you know what changed all that? Our wedding present list. Going round a big department store with this wonderful thing where you just sort of write down anything you want. It's like a marvelous sort of wish come true, as it were. But receiving all those presents and then being married has certainly changed my attitude to possessions. How about a car? As a single person, I used to get around on a push bike and then made the great graduation onto a little 70cc motorbike. As soon as I got married, I had a car. And then as the family has expanded more and more, a three-banker car. Now we've just had our fifth child. We're beginning to think we may need a larger car still. How about worries? St. Paul is talking about here. A family comes along, there are worries about the children's education, about influences on the children, how children will turn out. All of these things strengthen our ties to the world, but as a single person, we can do what all Christians are commanded to do as much as they are able, which is to loosen our ties to this world. That's the first great advantage that St. Paul puts before his readers here and us of the single life. Second, it can lead to deeper love of Christ. And this is the paragraph 32 to 35. I want you, he says, beginning in the same thought, to be free from anxieties. The unmarried man is anxious about the affairs of the Lord. That should, of course, have a capital L. How to please the Lord. But the married man is anxious about the affairs of the world, how to please his wife, and his interests are divided. And the unmarried woman and the virgin are anxious about the affairs of the Lord, so that they may be holy in body and spirit. But the married woman is anxious about the affairs of the world, how to please her husband. I say this for your own benefit, not to put any restraint upon you, but to promote good order and unhindered devotion to the Lord. When you're single, says St. Paul, when you're unattached, you can be single-minded, single-mindedly devoted to Christ. He talks at the end of verse 35 about unhindered devotion to the Lord. Literally, attending on the Lord without distraction. And Therion, again, Marriage and Celibacy, his book, says that this reminds us inevitably of Mary sitting at Jesus' feet, learning from him, undistracted by other cares and worries, able to devote herself to him. Jesus says, you've chosen the better part. Yes, says St. Paul, if you're single, all desire can be directed towards pleasing the Lord. Verse 32, the unmarried man is anxious about the affairs of the Lord, how to please the Lord, and growing in holiness. Verse 34, the unmarried woman and the virgin are anxious about the affairs of the Lord, so that they may be holy in body and spirit. This is simply not possible to the same extent for the married person, because the married person has another great aim, and a right aim, and that is to love and to please his or her partner. So Paul says in verse 33, and he's not in any way accusing or condemning the married person. He says the married man, verse 33, is anxious about the affairs of the world, how to please his wife, and his interests are divided. Not that he doesn't want to please the Lord as well, but he has two people whom he strongly wants to please, and whom it is his aim to please, and rightly so. Here are the plain facts, at least in my experience. My quiet time, my time alone with the Lord, has got shorter since I have been married. Of course, I still have time with the Lord, but I need to be there to help get the children up, to help them get off to school, help them with their breakfast. For a woman, certainly for my own wife, still obviously with comparatively young children, for most of our married life, Catherine has been snatching time to be able to pray or to read the Bible when she can. So much of these early years, we've been married 11, 12 years now, of her life has been taken up with bearing, caring for the children and for me. And much of my time, though certainly less than in her case, has been thinking about wanting to please the children and her. But singleness, says St. Paul, can lead to a deeper, richer, more concentrated love of Christ. And thirdly, he says, it can lead to more involvement in Christ's service. Some commentators think that's present in the phrase here, the affairs of the Lord. Verse 32, the unmarried man is anxious about the affairs of the Lord, how to please the Lord. Verse 34, the unmarried woman and the virgin are anxious about the affairs of the Lord. It may be. I'm not absolutely certain about that. But it certainly is the case, if you would turn on now to just to page 5, the opposite page, in 1 Timothy 5, verses 3 to 16. I won't read it all out, but it begins to our ears rather strangely. Verse 3, honor widows who are really widows. Now again, this is that real widows, slightly odd phrase, is a technical term for St. Paul here in this passage, and it means, first of all, at least he suggests, older women. He says in verse 9, they should be aged 60 and above. Secondly, they should be widows who have no one else to provide for them. So he says in verse 4, by contrast, if a widow has children or grandchildren, they should first learn their religious duty to their own family and make some repayment to their parents. In other words, they should provide for their widowed mother or grandmother. So these women, these real widows, are those who are, Paul suggests, older. They've no one to provide for them. And significantly, They have made a vow of permanent singleness, or rather of marriage to Christ. And we learn this from what he says about young widows, or younger widows, who may have been, quote-unquote, put on the list. That is, who have been enrolled as, quote, real widows and supported by the church. So verses 11 and 12, refuse to put younger widows on the list, for when their sensual desires alienate them from Christ, they want to marry, and so they incur condemnation for having violated their first pledge. Their pledge was to remain single, but they begin to want to marry. Or rather, as I say, to remain married to Christ. The phrase translated here, or the verb translated here, alienate them from Christ, literally means become wanton against Christ. They commit, says the commentator, speak, a sort of spiritual adultery towards Christ, who is their only husband. So what did these widows do, these real widows, who had deliberately refrained from marrying again? They gave themselves to prayer, verse 5. The real widow, left alone, has set her hope on God and continues in supplications and prayers night and day. That's exactly the emphasis we saw before about the single-minded devotion to Christ. But also, they gave themselves to ministry. So, verse 10, she must already be well attested for her good works. As one who has brought up children, this probably means children other than her own, foster children if you like, shown hospitality, washed the saints' feet, helped the afflicted, and devoted herself to doing good in every way. And it's quite likely as well that she was involved in home visiting. That is one of the implications probably of what is said about the younger women who misuse that ministry in verse 13, becoming gossips instead of giving themselves to ministry as they go from house to house. What the single person has is time for ministry. Now, it's often said when talking about single people and ministry that single people can be missionaries or they can engage in what one might call difficult ministry amongst drug addicts and so on. That is indeed true. It's no coincidence that many of those who continue in the late 20th century to be long-term missionaries, not all at all, of course, but many, are single, and that often married couples feel with children that they need to come back home to this country. But that isn't a great help to the majority of single people who don't feel called to missionary work or indeed to quote-unquote difficult ministry. But still, single people can be much more involved in the ordinary ministry of the church. That is to say, they can be more involved not just in love for Christ, but more specifically and practically involved in love for other people. When I was thinking about my own situation and whether I should remain single or get married, I happened at the time to be in Singapore looking at the possibility of going to work out in Singapore. And for much of the time I was staying with a married couple. He was a clergyman, and clearly he'd been in Singapore quite a long time, and his ministry amongst young adults had been particularly precious to him. And there were many young adults now going on into Christian leadership who had been nurtured under his ministry. One of the things that was most difficult was that when this man I was staying with got married, the kind of constant availability to the young men he was caring for was no longer possible. His wife understandably rather objected to their turning up without announcement at all hours of day and night. And the last straw was how frequently they shared the bathroom. And it was a matter of real regret to this friend of mine that his ministry amongst young adults had not altogether disappeared, but had been severely curtailed by his marriage. Marriage and family life take time. Family time is necessary every day. There are periods now when if you try to get in touch with me, if you ring me up, I simply won't be available. When I was single, that time around tea time, 5:30 to 7:30 is my family time, was especially available. It was a time when I often had people around. But it's simply not possible in the same way when you're married. So Paul is so convinced about the benefits, the advantages of singleness, that he is willing to compare the two, singleness and marriage, and to say that marriage is better. He's not saying that there are no disadvantages in singleness, but he is saying that the advantages are greater for the Christian. So he says it for those who have never married. Going back to 1 Corinthians 7, verse 36. So then he who marries his fiancée does well, and he who refrains from marriage will do better. He says the same thing to those who have previously been married and their partners have died. The next quotation there, verse 39, a wife is bound as long as her husband lives, but if the husband dies, she is free to marry anyone she wishes, only in the Lord, chapter 7, verse 39, but in my judgment, she is more blessed if she remains as she is. More blessed. Makarios is the word here. It's exactly the same word as Jesus uses in the Beatitudes. It can have the slightly watered-down version, more happy, but its normal meaning in the New Testament is more blessed by God. So to the unmarried, he says, the never married, he says it, to the widowed and bereaved, he says it. He says that the divorced must stay single if they cannot mend their marriage. If you look to the top of that page, 1 Corinthians 7, verses 10 and 11, to the married I give this command, not I but the Lord, that the wife should not separate from her husband, but if she does separate, let her remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband, and that the husband should not divorce his wife. So in all three categories of unmarried people, the never married, the widowed, and the divorced, to the first two he says, I think you'll do better remaining single. To the third he says, you must remain single unless your marriage can be repaired. Now in verse 10 of that, he is directly doing something he rarely does. He is quoting Christ. Christ, in addition to this, says two main things, and I will close with these two main things. First, he says, to take up the last point, that divorced people are to remain single. Now, my subject today is not primarily divorce, but if you would turn to page 2 to Matthew 19... Let me quickly run through this passage, Matthew 19, verses 1 to 12. It begins in verse 3 when some Pharisees come to Jesus and deliberately to trick him, to make it, put him in a difficult situation, they ask at the end of verse 3, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any cause? Jesus gives teaching about marriage and he ends with the direct answer to their question. In verse 9, I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for unchastity, and marries another, commits adultery. And some ancient authorities, actually probably not the best text you'll see in the footnote there, add, but certainly it is there in Mark and Luke, and he who marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Now, his disciples exclaim, verse 10, If such is the case of a man with his wife, it's better not to marry. If we can't get out of marriage into divorce, and then if we are divorced, if we can't marry again, goodness me, that's a terrible situation to be in. It'd be better not to marry in the first place. Jesus replies, no, you haven't understood me at all. He says, verse 11, not everyone accepts this teaching, but only those to whom it is given. For there are eunuchs who have been so from birth. There are eunuchs who have been made eunuchs by others. And, his punchline, there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. He who is able to receive this, let him receive it. Now, verse 12 is often taken to mean, for example, single missionaries, people who have renounced marriage because they are determined to forward the work of the kingdom of heaven. But no, very clearly, the primary meaning in its context is people who refrain from marriage after divorce. This is the demand, says Jesus, of the kingdom of heaven. This is the demand of Jesus the King. And those who obey him, who receive his word, his teaching, will make themselves eunuchs, that is, will refrain from marriage, remarriage, because that is what Jesus their King demands. Now to many that seems impossibly difficult to accept. People have written to me, how can you condemn my daughter to a life of permanent singleness just because her marriage broke down? But it is much more possible to accept this if you see God's view of singleness that we've been trying to grapple with so far, and that there are many ways in which singleness is better than marriage. So that's one thing that Jesus says, that divorced people are to remain single, and secondly, that there will be no marriage in heaven. And if you look at the 12th reference there on page 3, Luke chapter 20, verses 34 to 36, Jesus said, those who belong to this age marry and are given in marriage, but those who are considered worthy of a place in that age and in the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage. Indeed, they cannot die anymore because they're like angels and are children of God, being children of the resurrection. You remember this is Jesus' answer to the Sadducees, who postulated the situation where one woman had seven husbands, and they asked, which wife to whom will she be in the resurrection life? Now, I'm involved in my job in a lot of funerals, and very often when, say, the husband dies, the widow responds, I simply cannot wait to be with John again. That's a very understandable attitude. And I am sure, although of course we don't know, that there is much within that love that will remain and indeed be enriched. But we will not be married in heaven. I will not be married to Catherine. No married person here will be married in the heavenly life. No single person will be married. And this must make for us Christians marriage much less important. It relativizes marriage and explains why St. Paul can say that remaining single loosens our ties to this world. One last point that I need to make before we break for coffee and then have questions after the break. Is that right, or would you like me to take questions now and have the coffee break a little later? Well, no, you tell me.
After the break.
After the break, fine. Okay. So let me just refer you to Matthew 19, verse 12 and the end of it. Jesus says, after he's given his teaching, he who is able to receive this, let him receive it. Now the Greek word here, choreo, means both to understand and to accept. John, I really appreciated your prayer at the beginning because you prayed precisely this, that we should understand the Bible's teaching and then accept and obey it. I frequently pray that before I preach. First, we need to understand Jesus and Paul's teaching, the New Testament teaching. That means we need to study it, especially since we are in the normal course of church life so little exposed to it. And then we need to accept it. I deliberately stated Paul's three advantages in this way. Singleness can loosen our ties to this world. It can lead to a deeper love of Christ. It can lead to more involvement in Christian service, but only if we let it. If we are constantly hankering after marriage, we won't take advantage of these benefits of marriage, and we'll be worse off every way. I live in a small town. It's only really just more than a village. There are many advantages of living in that kind of community. Advantages for relationships, advantages for ministry. But I love towns, cities. If I hanker after city living, and that may come to me later on in my life again, I will lose all my enjoyment of being in the country now. Maybe, as I say, one day my love of the big city will be fulfilled again. Maybe it won't be. But I need to accept and make the most of all the advantages that living in Crowborough has given me now. And we're going to think in the second session, after a time of questions, how practically we can accept and embrace this teaching about singleness. I've been asked to say something about books. One of the people who has thought most about this issue in a practical way is a man called Steve Chilcraft, and he has edited, in each case with others, two books which we have on the bookstall. One is this book here, which is simply called One of Us, Single People as Part of the Church. And it is written by different people, mainly by Steve, actually, but by others as well, talking about how to be a single person, written principally from the single person's angle, how to live within the church as a single person. Men and women have contributed to this. And similarly, to this book, which is also edited by Steve Chilcraft and others, which is called Single Issues, A Whole Church Approach to Singleness. This is actually more of a workbook, and there are passages to read through, questions to read and answer, passages to read and answer questions on, action to take, prayer, and so on. And this can be very usefully studied in groups as well as singly. I hesitate to mention a book of my own, but I do it for two reasons. This book is actually now out of print, Divorce and Remarriage. I have brought four copies with me, which are at a slightly reduced price, still I'm afraid £14, because they are very mildly damaged. The text is fully there, but they got knocked about a bit coming across the Atlantic. That's really all that it amounts to. Several people over the break asked me about divorce, and this deals much, much more fully than I have wanted to today with the subject of singleness after divorce. But it also deals more widely with the issues that I've been trying to wrestle with today. And it isn't in print any longer, but it is, I think, the only book that's even recently been in print, at least from a Protestant biblical perspective, that seeks to grapple with the theology of singleness as opposed to only, it does try to deal with the practical issues as well, but the practical outworking